Today we are announcing that the second generation iTunes doesn't just run on the Mac, but it runs on Windows too. This is not some baby version of iTunes or the Music Store. It's the whole thing. iTunes for Windows is probably the best Windows app ever written.
Hello, and welcome to the Coldcast, the best 30-plus minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. I'm your host, Arifon Elijah. Joining me today, his dense thicket of chest hair is the envy of Wookiees everywhere. Buster, kind is here. that's solid. That's solid.
That's whatever, probably.
You could be an extra. New Star Wars Christmas episode. They need to get you in that. Also joining us, he's the Mike Tyson of the bar fight circuits. Leander, Katie is here.
Mike Tyson. More like Glass Joe, Hocus McGraw.
Glass Joe. Oh, what was that? What was that Mike Tyson's punch out character, like Hungry Hippo?
I was thinking more like the old guy that you fight in the first one, the Canadian old guy.
Wasn't that Glass Joe?
Yeah, I don't know.
He was a super easy guy to beat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I made it all the way to Tyson a few times. I don't want to brag.
What game is this?
Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. Have you heard of it?
No.
It was a Nintendo game, like one of like the most iconic games of the NES era, and it was like you had to make it all the way to the end through all the series, like all these crazy boxers, and then you get to Mike Tyson and he'd punch you once and the game would be over. He was impossible. I never beat him. There was probably some trick that I didn't know about, but you know, the internet wasn't like a thing back then, so you couldn't just get on the internet and be like, oh man, how do I beat Mike Tyson?
Your buddies didn't know it, you were out of luck.
Yeah, exactly. You had to call like Nintendo. They had like a Nintendo hotline.
Oh really?
And I think it was like $2.50 a minute, and they would have these giant binders of tips, and they would go through the binder for your game, and they would tell you how to get past the level. Yeah, it was a huge business for Nintendo.
That was actually a part of their official business?
Yeah, they made money on it. Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah, I don't know if they made a lot of money, but they made some. I mean, however much it was, it was like a dollar or two a minute. You know, it was crazy. So you had to like go as quick as you could, get as many tips as possible. Worked into that. You gotta have like a note card with all your questions. You get in there and get all your tips as fast as you could, so your parents didn't get mad at you. I thought we could start with something fun this week. It's actually Star Wars Celebration Orlando this week. And I wish I were Orlando. Buster and I were talking about this before we started recording, because the Star Wars Celebration is fun. You get to dress up in costumes and run around and pretend like you are a character in Star Wars and wear a sexy Leia outfit if you want. And I was thinking, what better way to celebrate Star Wars than to each of us to do a quick Yoda impression, the best that we can. You guys want to hear me? We can do a quick Yoda impression.
Hold on a second. I wasn't told about doing impressions.
Well, we didn't tell you on purpose because we knew you'd probably say no.
Yeah, I hate doing impressions.
But you're so good at them. Your German is spot on. You could move to Germany and they would make you a citizen.
Yeah, but how do you say it? Doing impressions, hate I do.
Is that so your Fiona?
Yeah, so sorry.
Make out with me, you will.
Buster, what do you got? Lay it on me.
Nothing I have. There you go.
Man, I definitely win.
That was the best one.
But your Wookiee was like an 8 out of 10, so I was expecting surprising.
Yeah, I didn't know we were doing impressions either.
Well, yeah, I didn't tell you guys on purpose, because then you'd both be like, no, I don't want to do it, and then we probably wouldn't have done it, but
right.
All right. That's why I got locked in.
Give me some minutes to practice, bro.
Yeah, I know. It's but sometimes the best ones are just the ones that you just do off the cuff, and then you're like, whoa, I did an excellent Yoda impression. Okay, well... We're going to be talking about some Apple stuff this week, as we often do. We've got some new NVIDIA drivers that will power the most beastly NVIDIA cards on your Hackintosh. We'll talk about that. We are going to, of course, be speaking about this secret mole that went and worked at the iPhone factory in China. And he came and did a big story about what his experience was like working there. We'll talk a little bit about that. And we'll wrap up with some talk about a guy that you may have heard of. He's a fascinating man. He is the man who threw away his winning lottery tickets, so to speak. His name is Ron Wayne, and he was the third investor at Apple when Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak first kick-started the company. He was the third guy. You may not have heard about him. And he threw it all away, and I'll tell you where he is today. We'll do a little where is he now that he didn't get any of his Apple stock. Let's start with a thank you, though, to VideoBlocks for supporting this episode. VideoBlocks is an affordable, subscription-based stock media site that gives you unlimited access to premium stock footage. VideoBlocks has one of the fastest-growing, largest stock video libraries with over 3 million videos, After Effects templates, and motion backgrounds. This includes the only contributor marketplace that gives 100% of the commission back to the artists. And this month, VideoBlocks is launching a new collection featuring hundreds of new Unreal clips, including space, VR, deep water, fantasy, and sci-fi footage. All of these come included with your subscription. And for a limited time, you can get free 4K clips from the membership library at no additional cost. And the best part, the downloads are yours forever, even after your trial ends, and the clips are 100% royalty free. Get started with your 7 days of free VideoBlocks. Head on over to VideoBlocks, VideoBlocks, VideoBlocks.com/cultcast, VideoBlocks.com/cultcast. Get started with your free trial. Oh, man. Let's start with So Long iTunes, Buster.
Peace out.
Do you think it's actually going away?
Oh, Kyle, they've needed to kill iTunes for the last 10 years, 5 years at least.
I feel like iTunes is like the Acrobat of the Adobe world, where it just keeps getting fatter and fatter and more bloated as they build in all these features, and it just does so many things now.
Yeah, it looks like maybe they're trying to maybe take some things outside of iTunes, or they're at least going to kill the iTunes brand, because today they announced that they're going to start calling podcasts Apple Podcasts instead of iTunes Podcasts, kind of like Apple Music. So, you know, maybe they could roll out just like a separate Apple Music app that has podcasts and music in it instead of iTunes. I don't know. The whole iTunes app, it's really old, really big, really horrible to use. So.
And I wonder if anyone's actually using it. I mean, I'm sure there are people using it, but it's got to be... It's got to be fewer and fewer people.
You know how like sometimes you click on a link to like an app or something and it brings up like iTunes and you're just like screaming, "No, don't open up iTunes." that's me all the time with iTunes. I'm like, if it opens up on my desktop, I get pissed off.
I haven't used iTunes in over a year, at least. I've just never even opened it because unless you have a big music library, There's no need to use it anymore.
Yeah, and the only people with big music libraries now are the people that are just still holding on to the past, you know, can't embrace digital streaming and stuff.
I still have a big music library, but I haven't used it in probably two or 3 years because I uploaded all my music to Google Play and was streaming via their app because they made everything available on the cloud. And now it's Spotify, and Spotify has literally every song that I own is in Spotify. So why,
right?
Why do all the music management yourself? What were you going to say, Leander?
Well, do you think that, you know, they've already unbundled it on iOS mostly, right? There's a separate podcast app. There's a separate sort of music app. There's still the iTunes Store, right?
Which is weird. Right.
But
they're all totally divided.
Desktop though?
I don't know. I kind of wish they would. Actually, I definitely wish they would make just an app for Apple Music and just that, just for streaming, kind of like Spotify has its own Mac app. That would actually be really good. So it's not tied to all the other junk that iTunes has with it too, like purchasing movies, everything. It's so stupid.
It is. It's odd that they've done that like on iOS, but they haven't done it on the desktop. You know, you'd think it would be an obvious thing to do, wouldn't it? Because it is a horrible spaghetti monster of a mess, isn't it? With so many things going on.
Yeah, I wonder also if it's just in some ways too big to kill. Like if they did do that, where would they put some of the other functionality from iTunes? Because obviously they're still making money off of individual song sales, movie sales, and stuff like that. So they'd have to put that and syncing and managing iOS devices into another tool, but it would be way easier for everybody if they did, I think.
Yeah, but who like you said, who uses iTunes to do any syncing and management anymore? Although, actually, the other day I backed up the phone and...
Yeah, I've had to... Right, a few times. Like, if you have, like, a phone where you want to, like... I've had, like, sometimes where I've wanted to, like, downgrade from a beta to the real whatever's out right now, iOS version. So sometimes I have to plug into iTunes to do that.
That's like, the one thing I actually still use iTunes for is iPhone management. But it's so rare.
Yeah,
there's got to be a way they could work around that. Maybe they could create, like, an iPhone management tool or something like that. It doesn't need to live inside of iTunes. I mean, that's really the thing, right? As you said, Leander, it's like it's the big jumbled mess of all these different tools that you may or may not use, and the user experience really has not been great for a while just because it does so much crap now. It's kind of hard to have the app be focused, and I would love to see them, break it out into Apple Music as just like its own thing, and then you could manage your music inside that if you wanted to. That's what Spotify does. I mean, you can actually import all your music into Spotify and use it within Spotify. It's, you know, like a music management app, and it will handle your own musical files if you want to import those, although I wonder how many people actually still do that. It's so legacy now. I mean, who's still buying MP3s on Amazon and iTunes anymore? It's just a relic of another age. It seems funny. I mean, it didn't seem that ancient 5 years ago when we started this podcast, but now it seems really old. Like, who actually still does that? And if we have any listeners that do still do that, reach out to me on Twitter. I'd be curious, genuinely curious to hear why you still do that. And
I still buy albums sometimes. Like, I'll definitely buy like the new Kendrick Lamar album when it comes out. Like, if there's an artist like I really want to support, like I'll buy their album on iTunes.
Oh, so you're doing it purely out of you want to support the artist.
Yeah, even though, like, you know, record sales don't go, like, straight to the artist, you know. It goes a lot to their label and other places. But, you know, if it's, like, an album I, like, really love, I think I bought, like, Beyonce's album. I'll buy Kendrick's album. I think I bought
Kanye's
album.
You bought Beyonce's album.
Oh, yeah.
The more we just let Buster talk, the more we're learning here that we had no idea. He's like, you know, there's just certain artists that you want to make sure stay out there making music. Like, yeah, I buy all Katy Perry's albums.
I want to keep Beyonce's kids in clothes, man. You know?
Yeah, so. They're hurting.
Definitely. It's very generous of you. Yeah, it's interesting. If I love a band, I go buy the t-shirt. But
that's a better way to do it, actually. Or
I wonder if
show.
They make more money off the t-shirt. Probably, because t-shirts more money are like $30.
Yeah, and usually artists have like deals where they get all the money from a t-shirt, the label gets like all the money from one shirt, stuff like that. They get way more money from shows, so go to a show, don't buy the album.
Yeah, I just paid a lot of money to go see Radiohead on next Tuesday.
Oh man, that would be a fun show to see.
Oh my goodness me, yeah, so much money.
How much was it?
Well, $330 for three tickets, so more than $1,000.
$330? Oh, they're $330 each?
Ticket?
Yeah.
For a Radiohead show?
Damn. It's Radiohead, though, man.
But isn't Radiohead, like, anti-capitalism? Like, why are they playing
at the Greek, though?
Yeah, it's at the Greek Theater. I got completely screwed by StubHub, you know? Yeah, well, Ticketmaster wasn't working. I was on it. The minute they went on sale, I was there clicking away. And, you know, it would just time out, and there's no way I could get in. And then I did some research, and it's all these bots. You know, people who know what they're doing set up a bot and snag up all the tickets at face price. So then I had to go into the aftermarket, which is StubHub, and buy them on the secondary market.
Take the raping.
Yeah, and I thought I was lucky to get that. And I was like, okay, F it, you know, I'll just do it. And I hit, and of course, since then I've had 2 months or 3 months of terrible, you know, buyer's remorse.
Yeah.
And when Tracy found out, oh my God.
It'll be worth it.
I promised my kids, I said to the kids, you know, like, we're going to go see it. And they're both, two of my oldest boys are big fans, right? You know, they're both Radiohead fanatics. And, you know, so I promised them, oh yeah, we're going to go. Oh, yeah, daddy's going to get tickets.
Don't you worry, daddy's going to handle it.
Exactly. And they were hassling me, you know, like, have you got them yet? Have you got them yet? You know, and so I just couldn't let them down, you know, it was just too.
But you got to look at it this way. You didn't pay $1,000 to go see a concert. You paid $1,000 to create beautiful memories with your children.
With my kids.
And in 10 years, you're not going to remember the $1,000, but you will remember the time that you went and saw the hopefully awesome Radiohead concert with your kids. I'm helping you here. This is gold stuff. You need to give this to Tracy. Are you taking notes on this?
All right, you're right. Exactly. Yeah,
you're dad of the year, in my opinion.
Right. Oh, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I saw Guns N' Roses, as some of you may know, and I spent, I think, $300 for that ticket. And I mean, it was like, I was basically just going to see Slash, because let's face it, you know, at this point, Axl Rose, he hasn't aged as gracefully as he maybe would have if he wasn't smoking cigarettes and drinking champagne mimosas every day for lunch. But it was awesome. And even though Slash, or even though Axl Rose didn't sound as good as he once did, Slash is even better than he used to be. He's a little chubbier. He's a little bit more rotund. The gentleman's top hat fits a little bit more snugly than it used to. But it was an amazing show, and even though I still slightly have buyer's remorse, I'm happy that I spent the money to go see it. I'm trying to go see you too.
Oh, really?
Oh man, those tickets. It's just like Radiohead, man. I mean, I don't know how people get tickets at face value. It seems like it's an impossible
task. Well, I found out after I did this, you know, telling somebody, and they said, oh, you know, I got mine the day before in the pre-sales. They put them up for city card holders. I was like, what? I've got a city card. You're kidding me. And he said, yeah, they have a special deal for city card holders and some other credit card as well. So I felt like a total dumb, you know, clerk. Like, I could not believe that. That made it even
dumb
worse.
Cluck.
Yeah.
That actually even routinely worse. Happens with credit card companies, but you never really know which ones
I don't know.
There
this.
Are,
I haven't bought a ticket for a concert for a long time, you know, and like, and I didn't realize that the whole thing was a huge fuster cluck. And the last thing you should do is do what
gobble,
I did.
Gobble, y'all.
Right, which is, you know, like get onto Ticketmaster and try to compete for the tickets. It's crazy. You know, like afterwards when I did some research, it was like, oh, yeah, that's a rookie mistake. You're an idiot for doing that.
But that's probably what most people do, because most people might see maybe one concert a year, one concert every 2 years. And so you just don't know to go through the side door. And yeah, those credit card deals are often the best way to get tickets for like the average layperson, because you get them before everybody else.
Yeah.
And but you know, what are you supposed to do? You don't know that. I mean, what can you do, right? You
just gotta
bend over tickets.
Guess, yeah. Well, I could have seen him last year at Outside Lands. I think that was $160 bucks, and I balked at that. I was like, $160 bucks for a ticket?
It's really
that's
expensive.
Crazy. And I ended up spending twice that per person.
Jeez. That's like front row money, which I'm sure you didn't get. You probably got
this isn't the lawn. This is the back. This is like the worst, you know. Yeah, the worst, cheapest tickets you can possibly get.
It's like, it's going to be like listening to the Lab album on Spotify, because you're going to be so far back. It's like, you're not even going to be able to see anything. It's like, you're gonna have to have binoculars to even see what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Okay, well, let's move on. Let's talk about some news this week that I found very, very titillating. This is the news about NVIDIA releasing their Mac drivers for their newest Pascal graphics cards. This is like the GTX.
Dude, that's funny. Like, who is interested in this other than you?
Oh man, so many people. Nips just got so stiff. You have no idea.
Oh, like Killian Bell in our UK writer. He was like raving about this in the Slack chat. Like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting, you know. And I think Lewis was just like, does anybody care about this?
Heck yeah, people care about this. So let me tell you why this is interesting news and why this is good news. And you're right, most people probably don't care two craps about this. So I'll keep this brief. The reason this is cool is because you can now use all of the newest NVIDIA cards, like the GTX 1050 through the GTX 1080 Ti. This is like the high horsepower Ferraris of the graphics world. You can now use these with your Mac, and you're like, well, wait, how would I do that? Well, you could get an external GPU case and plop one of these cards in it and use it on your Mac that you have now, probably, if you have a newer Mac. Or you can build a Hackintosh, and I think I'm only like 12 months away from building like a super high-powered Hackintosh, especially now that these cards are supported. The only thing I'm really waiting to see is the big thing with Hackintoshes for me is Final Cut Pro performance. I want to see how these cards do in Final Cut, because the AMD cards tend to do Final Cut better than the NVIDIA cards, even though the NVIDIA cards are much more powerful and are better for gaming and so on and so forth. But I'm waiting to see what the actual stats are on this card, or on these series of cards for Final Cut Pro. And if they're good, I'm building the Hackintosh. I'm not waiting for a new Mac to come out. I think I'm just going to build
my own. You said did you say 12 months away?
Yeah, why 12 months?
Well,
are you waiting to see what Apple does or what?
Well, I want to see what Apple does with a Mac Pro, and then
also you're going to be waiting a while.
I think it's going to be in 2018
or 19.
It might be 19, but I think it's going to be 2018. I don't think they would announce
2018.
Maybe. I don't think they're going to do 2019.
I'd build a Hackintosh. How often do you use Final Cut Pro? Making movies.
Not all that often, but no. I have plans to use it more often here in the future, which is why I'm like, I don't need it right now. And plus, you know, a Hackintosh is still expensive. It's going to be probably $1,600 to get all the components to build a high powered machine.
Right. And how much is that card on its own? The new cards, the Pascal cards.
Oh man, they are all over the place. I mean, the lower end cards might be $200, and the GTX 1080 Ti. I have no idea how much it costs. I know it's expensive though. It probably costs between $600 and I would say $1,000 for a really high end GPU.
I bet it's more than that.
So you're looking at a lot of money. And if it's not going to be used for Final Cut Pro or something like that, I don't really know why people want to use one of these. Well, I guess maybe if they're doing scientific stuff, they're clustering their computers together and doing calculations, maybe that makes sense. But if you're just going to get a gaming machine, why not just build a PC? Because PC games are, PCs support gaming much better than Macs do. So I don't know why you would want to use one of these for gaming on a Mac. In any case, the new drivers are out there in beta. You can download them. It's just great to have drivers for the modern cards.
I just looked at the price for the NVIDIA Quadro.
Yeah.
P6000.
The Quadro is a weird business graphics card, though.
Okay, all right. Well,
How much was it?
$5,500.
What? Yeah, okay, so those have... The drivers on those, I think, are what drive the cost. The drivers are built to be more robust than the consumer-grade drivers, from my understanding. But, yeah, the Quadro is a card that maybe you would get if you were in, in an industry
So which one should we look at? The GeForce ones?
Yeah. Yeah, the GTX 1050, the GTX 1060, the 1070, the 1080, any one of those.
Yeah, so the 1080 Ti is $700.
There you go, $700. Yeah, $700. That's a lot of money for just a graphics card.
Yeah, right.
But if you're into gaming and you want buttery smooth frame rates and you want to turn on every single feature onto its highest setting, then that would be worth it for you, you know? Okay, let's talk about some other exciting news. I know, Leander, you said this was exciting to you too. This was crazy to me, and I hope this ends up being something that comes to fruition. This is news about the Apple Watch. There may be a secret team working on a breakthrough diabetes treatment with the Apple Watch. Now, I know a lot of you probably don't have diabetes. I have several family members who have had diabetes, and it's a big problem. It's an epidemic, I think, in the U.S. And for those of you that don't know anything about it, the only way for you to check your blood sugar is to prick your finger. And imagine doing that 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 times a day. So that's the only way you can know exactly where your blood sugar is at, and then you have to inject yourself with insulin. So it's a big problem, right? According to a new report from CNBC, Apple has a secret team, currently working on developing a solution for treating diabetes that would be seen as the holy grail for the condition. The report says that Apple has hired a small team of biomedical engineers to work on the initiative, and they are working out of a small, unmarked, nondescript office in Palo Alto, California. And here is how the technology would work. It would shine light through the skin to measure glucose levels, and that way you could, at any time you want, accurately detect what your glucose levels are, and your watch could even tell you, hey, your glucose level is too high, you need to administer insulin. So it would take away all the guesswork out of managing your diabetes. And more than that, it takes away the pain. If you've ever had your finger pricked, it's not a huge pain, but imagine doing that 12, 15 times a day, all throughout the day, all the needles, all the pricks in your fingers that need to heal. It's not fun. And if you had something like this and it worked simply, easily, without you being involved on your Apple Watch, I think this is extremely exciting. Leander, you said this excited you too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think it's totally huge. And I think even more so for regular people than for diabetics, to be honest. You know, like the diabetic, obviously, you know, like I said, I don't want to underplay that. And there's a big market for that. Like I think there was it's a, like you said, it's so epidemic that it's a $12 billion a year industry on its own, I think, just for, you know, diabetic testing. But I think for ordinary people, you know, like I think there's definitely a, you know, there's a use case just for everybody, which is, you know, if you stuff your face with a bunch of donuts, you know, and you see your blood sugar rise, it's going to have a big effect on all these dieting apps, you know, all the calorie counting, you know, just for general, you know, health maintenance and weight maintenance, I think it would have huge applications. I mean, it would open up a whole new range of body monitoring, you know, apps. That would be huge, and it would definitely turn it into a must-have device, I believe. You know, I think if they could do this, if this is actually true, it could monitor your blood chemistry. It would, you know, it would be a total game changer for the Apple Watch, and it would become universal, possibly even bigger than the phone right now.
You might be right, and it would be. Wheelbarrows and wheelbarrows and wheelbarrows of cash for Apple.
Yeah,
it would
right.
make unbelievable amounts of money if they could figure this out. Well, this was an initiative first imagined by Steve Jobs, and according to the report, Apple's been working on it for 5 years, and it's come far along enough now that Apple has been conducting feasibility trials, clinical trials across the Bay Area, and has hired consultants to help it figure out the regulatory pathways to market the product, which means that they must have like a working prototype.
Yeah, well, there's been rumors about this for a long time, and it goes back, you know, several years. I know that this rumor popped up a couple of years ago, and people put together a pretty good list of all the people that Apple has hired. I mean, they've hired all the leading experts in the field from all these different startups. This is an effort that goes back to the 70s, you know, this to get a non-invasive glucose monitoring technology. And there's a couple on the market right now, but they're not non-invasive. You know, there's a watch you can actually strap to your wrist, and it sticks these little micro needles into the upper layers of your skin, and it pulls out, you know, lymph and tests that for glucose. But you know, like if they've got it, and this I think they've had some. There was a couple of startups. One of them, Apple snapped up a bunch of staffers from C8 MediSensors, which I took, you know, which is like a big hot startup 2 or 3 years ago, but then sort of flamed out a couple of years ago, and Apple snapped up some of their top staff. But they were working on they apparently had a working prototype back then. So, you know,
of Apple this technology.
Yeah, so Apple might be building upon that. But, you know, it's hugely, hugely expensive. And then and the trouble really begins at this stage where they try to get FDA approval. You know, because this is for it to be a medical device, I think is a 5 or 10 year effort. Because you know, if people want to administer insulin, this thing's going to be dead accurate, and it's going to be provably dead accurate in a clinical setting across a huge wide range of different users, different circumstances. There's absolutely no room for error at all, because it'll kill patients.
Right.
So you know, this is and I think it's been difficult for these startups because of the vast amounts of resources and money that it takes to get a device like this, you know, off the ground and through the regulatory process. But of course, you know, I mean, like one of the things that blew my mind in the last Apple, you know, when Apple released the Series 2, they were showing off, you know, all the effort they put into the swimming app, mm-hmm. in the workout app, you know, to record people swimming in open water or in pools. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, they were trying to measure people's, the VO2 and the calorie intake. And they had 700 people in pools strapped to these oxygen machines. And, you know, it was just like a 30-second video in the Apple presentation, but my mind was absolutely blown. I mean, you know, they've had a team of people, so it's probably just dozens and dozens of people, 700 volunteers, just to get, you know, careful calibration for one of the workouts in the app. The resources that Apple has at its disposal is absolutely mind-boggling.
I know, it's crazy.
And so, yeah, so something like this, you know, I mean, Apple's really at a huge advantage with all the money they have in the bank, all the resources they have. You know, if anyone is going to do it, it's going to be a company like Apple that would do it. You know, like Fitbit can't compete with this. Fitbit, there's no way. So a company like Fitbit or Pebble or any of the other,
Smartwatch
manufacturers,
manufacturers.
There's no way they could do anything like this. Apple would leave them in the dust. You know, is leaving them in the dust with this kind of thing.
It's really true. It's funny because it's true. I mean, they have so much money, and they have every resource at their disposal. There's just few companies that could even attempt to take on something of this magnitude.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So if they're doing it, and if it does come through, I think it's a huge game changer for the watch and for the whole wearables industry. You know, because then they're going to start monitoring other things, like because the glucose molecule is really, really small, and I think it's very, very difficult to detect. And but if they can do that, then they can start detecting, potentially start looking at other molecules in the blood, and also things like, you know, I mean, they said they can already detect tremors, right, with early indications of Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, like with heart problems, heart arrhythmias, it could tell you, like, you know, apparently a heart attack is detectable a couple of days before it actually happens.
Wow.
And if they get, if they get FDA approval, if they turn the Apple Watch into a medical device and start going down that path. You know, at the moment it's a fitness device, right? But if they start turning it into a medical device, then I think, you know, it really does become a game changer for the Apple Watch. And like I said, you know, then I think it will become a universal product. More so, especially if it could save your life. Like if it could tell you you're going to have a heart attack in a couple of days, get yourself to the doctor, you know, right now. I can't see that there's any circumstances when people wouldn't want this kind of thing, especially for a few hundred dollars.
Yeah, at that point I think it might become ubiquitous for sure.
Right, and if it starts monitoring your blood chemistry and, you know, telling you whether it's not a good idea to eat that stuff or go get some exercise or whatever, you know, I think there's a whole bunch of, you know, really unthinkable applications for it.
Imagine the Apple Watch store would be totally changed from like little fitness monitoring apps to stop my heart attack free, right. Which will tell you, you know, like a day before your heart attack is going to come, or stop my heart attack pro, which only costs $1 and will notify you up to 2 or 3 days in advance of your heart attack.
Yeah, so
you go to your doctor and be like, I'm going to have a heart attack tomorrow. I'm going to need you guys to go ahead and take care of that for me.
Right. I'm great now.
Okay. Well, let's move on to undercover in an iPhone factory, what it's really like to work in a Chinese mega factory. This was a big story this week. I'm sure many of you probably at least heard about it, if not read the Business Insider interview with this NYU. He was NYU, right? Graduate student.
Right.
Who, was he like working with Business Insider, or did he just decide to do this on his own accord to
no,
go
he
and
did
work
it
in
on
this
his
iPhone factory?
Yeah, he was... He did it on his own thing. He gave a speech a couple weeks ago, actually, and I think that is what turned Business Insider on to interview him about it.
Okay. So he goes through and he talks about what it's like to actually work in the Pegatron factory that manufactures your iPhone. And I think a lot of the information that was in the interview is stuff that you would probably expect. Like, it's not a fun place to work. You know, security is pretty strict, stuff like that. But it definitely gave me a much more intimate insight into the device that I'm holding in my hand at this very moment, and what the cost is. You know, not the monetary cost, but what the cost is to actually make one of these. And I found it to be interesting, but also a little bit heartbreaking, even though I kind of knew some of this stuff. Leander, what were your thoughts after reading some of this stuff?
Well, you know, I thought reading this latest one, I thought, my God, things have got a lot better than they used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, when workers were throwing themselves off the top of buildings and there was, you know, a rash of suicides. And because Mike Daisy, you know, like he was really attacked by the Apple community in what I thought was a really shameful way. But of course, you know, it turned out that he'd fudged, you know, he'd taken what he'd read in news reports and made it sound like he'd actually witnessed it firsthand.
Was that the controversy around him? Because I know we talked about him years ago. And for those that don't know, Mike Daisy he's an amazing orator. He tells stories.
Dramatist, yeah.
And he would tell people what it was like from a firsthand experience working in these factories. And I saw him at Twitter, and it was outstanding.
Yeah. His show was devastating, I thought. And, you know, more so than this interview, it was a one-man show, and it was about how he traveled to China and he met up a bunch of these workers. And it was, like I said, the human cost of these phones. And this, of course, was like when the iPhone was really, really taking off, five years ago, right? When I think Foxconn was having a lot of trouble like meeting demand for the giant numbers of these phones. So they were recruiting all kinds of, you know, like 500,000 workers to put the phones together. And, you know, they were putting them into really, really long hours, really, really unsafe conditions. You know, there was a big, there was explosions, that there was one explosion at that one factory, one of Apple's suppliers. You know, people getting poisoned with all these chemicals they were using to put the phones together to clean them. You know, I think the abuses were a lot worse than they used to be. And in fact, this latest interview to me was like, you know, Apple, after these suicides, Apple pledged to clamp down, and they really started to take seriously, you know, that code of conduct, the supplier code of conduct they put together, mm-hmm. you know, because there were all kinds of abuses, you know, child labor, huge and involuntary overtime, super low wages, really bad working conditions, horrible, horrible safety. And so reading this latest Business Insider one, you know, he mentioned that they'd really improved.
I wonder if they're hiring. That's
they'd really improved their safety. And it reminded me, I've done a bunch of factory jobs, you know, when I was younger, and it sounded routine, you know, for a factory job. The worst thing about it is the repetition, the boredom, the stupidity. You know, you these people are basically... you know, they're cannon fodder for the upcoming robot revolution. I mean, these jobs won't exist in a 2 or 3 years at all.
Actually, these are the people that that will survive because they have the skills to keep the robots repaired. It's the rest of us that can't do that work that are going to be destroyed by the AI. Yeah, I've done repetitive work like this before too. And when I was in college, I would do like day jobs, and they would have you go to these factories where you would be responsible for screwing in a light bulb into like a machine, and you would do that all day. And that was the part, that was actually one of my biggest takeaways from this piece, is how simple the work is that they make for these people to do, because these people are basically replaceable cogs in this machine. And for such a complex device like an iPhone, you would think there would be a bunch of complex tasks that would have to be actioned in order to create one. But this guy's job was screwing in a speaker into the iPhone. And that is all he would do all day long. He would just take the screw, screw it in. Take the screw, screw it in. And he would do that for 10 to 12 hours a day. That would be enough to make you want to jump off the building, in my opinion. I mean, can you imagine doing that for 12 hours a day?
Yeah, but it's actually not that bad if you're busy, right? Because you can totally get into it. Like he was saying, he described that at first it was like overwhelming. He couldn't keep up. But then he could keep up. And you know, like his description was that he didn't even have time to think, so he didn't even know time was going by. The worst factory job I ever had was testing batteries at this French battery plant in Brighton, and I had to sit there. And you had to put these two batteries into this machine, and then wait while it clicked up, while it counted the voltage or the charge on the battery. Mm-hmm. And so there was like a 15-second delay. That 15 seconds was the longest 15 seconds in the entire cosmos. Like it became so long that it was like it was a huge yawning gulf, you know, of time that would just killed me. That was like, I only worked in that factory for about 2 weeks, but I swear up and down, that was the worst 2 weeks of my entire life. It was absolutely excruciating and unbearable because of that delay. Like the best job, you can do a terrible job if, you know, like how many, we've all done horrible jobs, right? You know, like working as a dishwasher, but if you're busy, it's fine because you don't notice the time going. You know, you can lose yourself in the task. Mm-hmm. I find anyway. Like I don't mind doing a crap job as long as you're busy. That you know, and you don't have to pay attention to time. The paying attention to the time is the worst thing. That's the worst torture.
Totally. I used to work at the Gap in the mall. And when it was slow, you're just like, oh my gosh, you're looking at the clock every 5 minutes, and it's like only 5 minutes have passed. Right. You know?
I know, it literally stops still. Doesn't it?
Yeah. I used to be they would make me be the greeter at the Gap. You know, so you'd walk in, and I would be like, hey, how you doing? Welcome to the Gap. You know, it's terrible, terrible. But because I like to smile and talk, they would make me do it.
Yeah.
And when it was slow, you're just literally just standing there at the front of the store doing absolutely nothing, just waiting for someone to come walk in. Oh, it's terrible. So overall, I would say, as you said, Leander, like this guy made it sound like this is a bad job, but it's not like they're being mistreated. It's just a crappy low entry job. And actually, I was surprised to learn it pays better than other minimum wage jobs in the area.
Like I said, he walked in. You get hired that day. You walk in. You know, can you read? Do you have? And the hardest part was getting past the HIV test, apparently, right? And pregnancy. Like, they test you to make sure you weren't pregnant or you carried the HIV virus.
Well, he didn't say. He said that they wouldn't hire you if you were pregnant, but if you had HIV, he wasn't sure because they would make you take a test, but he didn't say whether or not.
Yeah, it wasn't disqualifying.
But no, definitely no tattoos over 10 centimeters. Yeah, that's a big
what was
no.
that one? What was that about?
I have no idea. No. Why would that be a thing? No tattoos over 10 centimeters. apparently, you're not Apple material if you got a tattoo bigger
tattoo,
than that.
Tattoo, yeah.
But they also said that Apple was constantly doing audits. They're constantly on the floor, walking around. I mean, they're clearly very involved in the day-to-day operations of this place to make sure that it's treating people the way Apple expects them to be treated.
Right. And security was very tight. You couldn't take any electronics in. You had to go through metal detectors. Yeah. It was, in fact, detecting women's bras, right? You know, like the clasps and stuff.
That's right.
Bras.
No underwire. Right. If you've got large rotund gazangas, you better take that underwire out because that's not getting in. They'll make you change. And what they make you change into? Imagine how nice the Pegatron paper bra must be. and they said they would get paid about 3,100 yuan a month. Am I saying that right? Yuan a month, which is about $450 a month. So to build iPhones for 12 hours a day, you make $450 a month. And a lot of those people, according to the story, send the money back home to their families who live in more rural areas of China, which is what a lot of people are doing there. Right. I actually found that part of the story to be quite sad. And it made me very grateful to live in the place that we do because, like, a lot of these people, well, not a lot, but a portion of them have kids, and they're there busting their ass so they can send money home so that their kids can live and their families can live, but you're working so much you don't ever have a chance to see them, and everyone that works here lives in these dorms that are like 10 minutes away from the Pegatron factory, and you're carted in and out every day by a shuttle, and your family may live 100 miles away, 500 miles away, and you're there living in a dorm working in this factory making money. And I was like, that's just sad that people are trading time with their family in order to be able to send money to their families so their families can live.
It's not an uncommon situation.
Yeah, it's not an uncommon situation, I'm sure, in a lot of places. And you know, these people aren't forced to work there. When you describe conditions like this that aren't the conditions that most people would want to work in, a lot of people are quick to point out, well, these people aren't forced to work there. And that's true. They're not. They're working there because this job pays better than a lot of the other opportunities that are available to them in that area. So these people are actually treated better than in many places in China. So this is a good enough job, especially for someone who doesn't really have a lot of skills. But it's still, you know, not a great job. And it's probably exactly what you would expect if you're working at a factory in China. Lots of very strict management yelling at you all the time. If you fall asleep at your station or something. And then all these like odd rules that he was talking about, like you can't lay down, and if you lay down, you get in trouble, but you're allowed to sleep as long as you're sitting up. Like just all these strange management rules. It's like, it's almost like you're a teenager or you're living at like Hogwarts or something, and you're being managed by like some instructors or some parental units or something. It's like you're not treated like an adult when you work there, which I found to be strange.
Again, par for the course, I think. I got the impression that a lot of people that work there were kids, you know, that you know, they're coming to the big city from rural areas, you know, don't have, you know, it's an entry level job for a lot of young people. Young people, I think, you know, I think there's armies and armies of young people that get hired there, and they tend to like, you know, they and a lot of them don't last very long. It's like 2-3 months, and they go on to get a job in another factory somewhere else, or you know, a different, you know, or go back home.
Yeah, he said there was a high turnover rate. And people constantly coming in and out. And he made a point towards the end, which I thought was really interesting, and that was people have talked a lot about factories moving to the U.S. and bringing these jobs back to the U.S. And he said, I think that if that happened, a lot of these jobs would be replaced by machines because people don't want to do these jobs. And the reason that they have people in China do them is because people in China don't make a lot of money, so it's cheaper to have them do jobs like this. But if you brought these jobs to the U.S., the entire thing would be done by a robot, like that amazing robot they showed in that commercial a long time ago that takes apart an iPhone. Remember that thing? What was that thing's name? Hugh or something?
Yeah.
Liam?
Liam, yeah, it was Liam. I mean, they just got to turn the reverse switch on that thing. Right?
Yeah.
Just flip the switch and that thing's going the other direction. It's putting together your iPhone.
Well, Foxconn is investing heavily in robots anyway, isn't it? So I think a lot of them, from what I understand, a lot of the manufacturing is already computerized or automated. It's like a lot of the final assembly is a little bit too tricky for robots at the moment. But I'm pretty sure that more and more of it is getting automated, and within a few years, for sure, even those assembly jobs are going to be gone away. I mean, look at Tesla now. You know, the Tesla factory is like with cars. You know, I think the Tesla factory is almost all completely automated, isn't it? I don't know if there's very much manual assembly anymore in cars. I think it's almost all done by robots, I believe.
Or highly qualified people who are running robotic machinery or something.
Yeah, but you go to the Tesla plant down here in Fremont, you know, which is only a few miles away here from San Francisco, and it's a big factory, lots of robots and very, very few people. There are some tasks I know that people do in conjunction with the robots, some of the finer stuff, but I don't think there's very much. You know, it's almost all automated from what I know.
And I think increasingly we're going to be heading that direction.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Especially as wages go up.
Because these robots run 24 hours a day.
Yeah, and they don't make mistakes.
No, and they don't have to go on vacation.
And they don't have to lie down at their stations
right.
to take a nap.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, before we move on, let me go ahead and tell you guys about Casper, the obsessively engineered mattress available to you at a shockingly fair price. Casper mattresses are made from supportive memory foams, and they create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right amount of sink and just the right amount of bounce. And you can try a Casper for 100 nights free in your own home. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit to it. And they know that because you spend a third of your life on a mattress, you need to love it before you trade your hard-earned ducats. And I would encourage you to do this. Go check out the reviews on Casper on Amazon. They're also on Casper's website. They have over 20,000 reviews and an average 4.8 star rating. They are the internet's favorite mattress. And if you are waking up with a sore back, a sore neck, limbs, members, if you will, that are asleep and numb and then start tingling when you wake up, you probably need a new mattress. You should definitely give one a shot, and you can just prop your current mattress up against your wall, put Casper mattress down on your bed, and try it out. There's nothing to lose. There's no risk to you, so it's worth a shot. Head on over to casper.com/cultcast. You can peruse the different size mattresses available, and if you decide to purchase one, you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase just by using code cultcast at checkout. That is casper.com/cultcast and use the offer code cultcast at checkout. Terms and conditions do apply. Alrighty, let's talk about the saga of Ronald Wayne. Landy, you said you got to meet him once, didn't you?
Yeah, I've met him a couple of times.
He seems like one of the nicest guys.
Super nice guy.
And he's very articulate. I was reading some of the things that he said about working with Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. In fact, I'll just read you this right here. He said, when I was 40, these kids were in their 20s, and he was referring to Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, of course. They were whirlwinds. It was like having a tiger by the tail. If I had stayed with Apple, I would probably have wound up the richest man at the cemetery. He also said about Steve Jobs, he was a very focused fellow. You never wanted to be between him and where he wanted to go, or you'd find footprints on your forehead. To put it simply, if you had your choice between Steve Jobs and an ice cube, you'd probably nuzzle up to the ice cube for warmth. But that's what it took for him to churn Apple into what it became. He talks like he is an author. He's right. So articulate in the way he speaks, and yet he is very kind and matter of fact.
He was the third co-founder of Apple, right? And he was actually the first one to put any money into it. So this is back when they were in, a couple of college dropouts, and they were making these computers they were making motherboards in Jobs' parents' garage, and they incorporated Apple, the three of them together, and he put in $800, right, for his one-third share.
$800. That he literally purchased the Willy Wonka golden tickets.
Right, for $800, a third of all Apple shares.
And he did he have a third?
I forget how they divvied
it up. I think
it
was 10%. I think he got 10% of Apple shares.
Oh, is that all? Okay. So even,
I think so. But imagine 10% of Apple shares, what that would be worth today. I didn't do the calculation. I would imagine it would be billions and billions and billions of dollars.
Right, yeah.
It would have been the greatest investment of all time, actually.
They didn't have anything then, did they? I mean, maybe they did. I don't even know if they were building motherboards then. Maybe they were about to start getting ready to build motherboards for the first Apple One. So no customers, no product. You know, two hippie kids.
One of them smelled very bad.
Right, because he didn't shower.
He didn't believe in showering.
Yeah, I was a sociopath.
And it was a total sociopath. It would scream at you for any of the most minor
the
slights.
Thing, yeah. And the other one wouldn't actually give the products away. You know, Wozniak just actually wanted to give away his computer. He wasn't interested in selling it. He wanted to give it to all his buddies at the homebrew computer club.
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, one of them was like the angel on your shoulder. One of them was the devil.
The way he
talks about them. One of them was super driven. One of them was like really not that ambitious, but very kind.
Yeah.
And so Ron Wayne met Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs at Atari. And as Leander said, they decided to form Apple together. And Wayne drew Apple's original logo, that really cool... Newton sitting under a tree logo. It looks like it was like etched in wood or something. They had split up their roles. Wayne was Woz was responsible for electrical engineering, and Jobs was responsible for marketing, and then Wayne was responsible for mechanical engineering and documentation. When you talked to him, Leander, did you talk to him about his sentiments on what it was like working with them, why he left, and then how he feels about seeing Apple's huge success now, and he's just not part of it?
Yeah, well, he's very philosophical about it. Of course, you know, it's he says that he made the what he thought was the best decision at the time.
Yeah,
which was to cash in his $800. He didn't want the risk, I think. You know, he thought that they were going to get into trouble, or we're going to get sued. It was going to be a liability. He wanted a quieter life. He didn't think there was going to, you know, that wasn't the best case scenario. The worst, you know, more likely nothing was going to come of it. He thought it wasn't going to go anywhere.
And he was probably right. I mean, think of how many startups there are and they don't go anywhere.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Precisely. And I think, you know, he'd been involved in, like you said, he was twice the age and he'd been involved in quite a few ventures. I think he was doing pretty well. He was making a good living as an engineer at Atari. He was, you know, quite happy with his life, and I don't think he wanted the headache and the risk. So he cashed it in. But of course, you know, fast forward 30, 40 years, and it's, you know, one of the world's biggest.
Oh my gosh!
One of the world's biggest blunders in business. You know,
how do you think you would feel if you had purchased 10% of the shares in a company and then sold them back for $800, and then that company was worth billions and billions of dollars today, like? Do you think you would ever be able to let that go? I'm not sure I would.
I don't know. He's like you said, he's remarkably philosophical about it. You know, he has not let it slip that it's ever upset him, which and I think it's actually quite sort of noble, quite remarkable, really, because
I
think a lot of people, you know, would, you know, turn into alcoholics, or, you know, they drink themselves into a stupor, you know, because it's just like, how could I have made such a blunder? And they'd be thinking about all the what could have beens, but he remarkably doesn't, and I think it's unusual. It really is unusual. You know, you don't meet a lot of people who had such a, you know, a brush with history and are so stoic about it. You know, it's he's like, well, you know, it just he talks about it quite openly. He'll talk about it to anybody. He's done a bunch of interviews.
He's like 80 now, isn't he?
I'm not sure how old he is. Yeah,
he must be because he was 20 years older than Woz and Steve. And what is Woz like? He's probably like 60 something.
Yeah. And he lives in a town outside of Las Vegas, like in the middle of the desert. And
he lives in Pahrump, Nevada, an unincorporated town about 16 miles west of Las Vegas. He lives on his Social Security checks and money made selling rare coins and stamps over the internet. I just laugh because can you imagine you buy a stamp from a guy who, like, on eBay, you're on eBay and you buy some like $50 stamp, and it's this guy who founded, who co-founded Apple, and here he is making his living selling rare stamps on eBay. It's just such an insane story.
Yeah,
it's an insane story.
Well, he's done a bit of traveling. He goes to tech conferences, and you know, I've met him a couple of times at Macworld here in San Francisco. You know, so it's kind of remarkable how stoic he is about the whole thing, and how, you know, stiff upper lip he is. He never lets it slip. If he does have any regrets, he definitely has, as far as I know, has never ever uttered a word about it.
He's so noble about the whole thing. And when you hear what he has to say about Woz and about Steve Jobs, he has the most elegant, kind-hearted things to say about both of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's a class act, to be honest.
He really is. He really is. Like, and that's the heartbreaking part of this story is, if anyone was going to get rich off Apple, this guy deserved that fame and that money. So it's just such a bizarre story. Well, when he was asked about passing on Apple, he had this to say. He said, "You just pick yourself up and move on. I don't want to waste my tomorrows bemoaning my yesterdays."
Right.
Isn't that just a beautiful statement? It sounds like a song lyric.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like something John Lennon would have written.
This is like a part of a Paul Simon song right here.
Yeah.
If I were Steve Jobs, I would have tossed a few mil his way. Why not?
Are you kidding?
Toss him a few mil. Well, I know Steve Jobs would never do that. He would never do that. That's what I'm saying. If I were Steve Jobs,
he wouldn't toss it to the guy he went to India with. You know, his best friend from high school, Daniel Cocky. He didn't give him anything.
Wait a second. Well, why would he give that guy any money?
Well, he was working. You know, Cocky was working with him at Apple for a long time, but he decided he wasn't in a quote unquote management position and wasn't eligible to have a bunch of shares.
So is he one of the guys that Woz gave some of his stock to?
Yeah, so Woz gave him or sold him a bunch of shares at a really discounted price. In fact, Woz did that for a whole bunch of people because Jobs cut out a whole bunch of early people, saying that I think there was a cutoff. You know, that it was only upper management or mid to upper management got shares when they went when they did their IPO. And so a lot of people who'd been there who didn't have those managerial positions, you know, they were co-founders, or not founders, but they were founding staff. They were there from the very beginning. You know, a bunch of them got cut out. I think Woz helped dozens, if not hundreds, of people.
Man, that's crazy to hear, because I grew up in Redmond, Washington. As many of you know, that's the hometown of Microsoft. And I have met people that started off as janitorial services at Microsoft early in the days, and now they're millionaires because they stayed there and got stock. And even all those people who didn't directly contribute to the product at Microsoft still ended up getting rich.
Right. I know, it's a famous story. There's a lot of people. There's there's the Google's early chefs. You know, people who and at Facebook too. You know, like if you get in early, you get to share in the bounty. So.
Oh my God, Steve Jobs doesn't even want to give it to people that were working on the project, or on the product itself. That's just crazy. Anyway, Ronald Wayne, a class act, the third founding member of Apple that you may have heard existed, but maybe didn't know very much about. We remember him. We honor him in today's Cultcast, and I think that wraps it up. That's all the Cultcast we have for you guys this week, but if you want to come say hi to us on Twitter, we would love to hear from you. I'm at Arifon, Buster's BST3R. Leander is L. Caney. This has been the Cultcast, the best 30-plus minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the Cultcast come out every Thursday night. I want to thank everyone for listening, and
see you next time, we will.
Thanks, Yoda.
Pretty good. What's with the Yoda impressions? Why Yoda?
It's Star Wars Celebration today.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Looks so good in her German bathing suit. I don't know. It doesn't really make any sense, does it?
Oh, Leanne Dieter. I read that as lean dieter.
Lean dieter.
I'm like, oh, yeah, wow.
Yeah, either works. Lean dieter.
Either works. Yeah. You are a very lean man. At least you were last time I saw you.
Don't say that.
Well, I've gained 4 sizes since then.
You're like, well, I actually gained 300 pounds since then.
Been cycling my bike. I have to wear those tight jerseys, and it's really not a good look.
Do you still cycle a lot, Leander?
Well, I've been trying to, yeah, the last couple of weeks.
Good for you.
Weekends. Getting back into it. Nice.
Yeah. I'm pushing it. I'm up to about 65 miles now.
Holy moly. Doesn't it make your bollocks hurt, though? I mean, the bikes are terrible.
And your gooch. Yeah, you know?
That's like, what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah.
Serious gooch aggravation.
Well, there's some secrets that I learned. One is you put this chamois butter on, which is this sort of slippery.
Butter?
It's a slippery viscous lubricant.
Oh, uh-huh. Wonderful.
So you got to put a lot of that on. Yeah, and then you have to reapply.
A lot. The key is a lot. Yeah. Really just get it in there. Rub it on there.
Someone caught me reapplying it the other day on the side of the road. I felt very bad for him.
What is that guy doing touching himself on the side of the road?
Oh, it's worse than that. It's like really getting your hand down there.
Ain't no rapage.